Side 6, The Hidden City, The Tomily, Book 3, by David Eddings, continuing on page 184. Let's say that I tell Valish that I've picked up a very reliable report that a fleet of ships flying church banners has rounded the southern tip of Daconia, bound for Kaftal. Wouldn't that cause the other side some concern? Even if they know about the knights coming across Zemok, they'd still have to send troops to meet that fleet. They couldn't ignore the possibility that the knights are coming at them from two different directions. Stragan suddenly laughed. What's so funny?
You and I have been running together for too long, Talon. We're starting to think alike. I came up with the idea of telling Valish that the Aetons are going to cross the steppes of Eastern Astel and strike down into northern Seneska toward the capital.
Nice plan, Talon said.
So's yours.
Stragan squinted out across the moon-bathed water.
Either story's strategically credible, he mused. They're exactly the kind of moves a military man would come up with. What we're really planning is a simultaneous strike from the east and the west. If we can make Sirgon believe that we're going to hit him from the north and south instead, we'll pull him so far out of position that he'll never be able to get his armies back to meet our real attacks.
Not to mention the fact that we'll cut his army in two.
We'll have to be careful, though, Stragan cautioned. I don't think even Valish is gullible enough to swallow these stories if we drop them both on him at the same time. We'll have to spread them out and dribble them to him a bit at a time. What I'd really like to do is let the fairy tale about the Aetons come from someone other than me.
Sparhawk could probably get Afriel to arrange that, Talon suggested.
If he ever comes back. His note was a little vague. Let's get things rolling, though. We can modify your story a bit. Push your make-believe fleet back to Valesia. Give Sirgon some time to worry about it before we pinpoint Kaftal as the final destination. I'll plant a couple of hints about the Aetons massing up near their northwestern frontier. We'll let things stand that way until Sparhawk comes back.
Talon sighed.
What's wrong?
This is almost legal, isn't it?
I suppose you could say so, yes. Is there some problem with that?
If it's legal, why am I having so much fun?
Nothing? Olaf asked, opening the neck of his red uniform jacket. Not a peep, Tinian replied. I cast the spell four times, and I still can't raise her.
Maybe she's busy.
It's possible, I guess.
Olaf rubbed at his cheek reflectively.
I definitely think I'll shave off Sir Gerda's beard, he muttered. You know, it could be that it's because we're in no time. When we did this the first time, back in Pelosia, none of our spells worked.
I think this spell's different, Olaf. I'm not really trying to do anything. I just want to talk with Afriel.
Yes, but you're mixing magic. You're trying to use a steric spell when you're up to your ears in a trollish one.
Maybe that's it. I'll try again when we get to Arjun and go back into real time.
Blockuff came shambling back through the gray light of Gnome's frozen moment, passing a flock of stationary birds hanging in the air.
There are some of the dens of the man-things in the next valley, he reported.
Many or few?
Olaf asked him.
Many,
Blockuff replied.
Will the man-things have dogs there?
There are always dogs near the dens of the man-things, Blockuff.
We should hurry then.
The shaggy troll paused.
What do the man-things call this place?
It is the place Arjun, I think.
That is the place where we want to go, is it not?
Yes.
Why?
The wicked ones have told the one called Barret to go there. It is our thought that we should go there in Gnome's broken moment and listen to the bird talk of the man-things. One of the wicked ones may say where the one called Barret is to go next. The next place may be the place where Annika's mate is. It would be good to know this.
Blockuff's shaggy brow furrowed as he struggled his way through that.
Are the hunts of the man-things always so not simple?
He asked.
It is the nature of our kind to be not simple.
Does it not make your head hurt?
Olaf smiled, being careful not to show his teeth.
Sometimes it does, he admitted.
It is my thought that a simple hunt is better than a not simple hunt. The hunts of the man-things are so not simple that sometimes I forget why I am hunting. Trolls hunt things to eat. The man-things hunt thought.
Olaf was a bit startled at the troll's perception.
Your thought may be good, he admitted. The man-things do hunt thought. We put much value on it.
Thought is good, Ulat, but you cannot eat it.
We hunt thought after our bellies are full.
That is how trolls and the man-things are different, Ulat. I am a troll. My belly is never full. Let us hurry. It is my thought that it will be good to know if the dogs of this place are as good to eat as the dogs of the other place.
He paused.
I do not wish to cause you anger, Ulat, but it is my thought that the dogs of the man-things are more good to eat than the man-things themselves.
He scratched at his cheek with one shaggy paw.
I would still eat a man-thing if my belly was empty, but I would like a dog better.
Let us go find you a dog, then.
Your thought is good, Ulat.
The huge beast reached out and affectionately patted Olaf on the head, nearly driving him to his knees. The child goddess touched her fingertips lightly to the sides of Engessa's broken head, and her eyes became distant. Well? Vanyan asked, his tone urgent. Don't rush me, Vanyan. The brain is very complicated. She continued her gentle probing. Impossible, she said finally, withdrawing her fingers. Betwana groaned. Please don't do that, Betwana, Afriel said. All I meant was that I can't do it here. I'll have to take him someplace else to repair him. The island? Vanyan guessed. She nodded. I can control things there. This is still Seneska, Sirgon's place. I don't think he'd give me permission, no matter how sweetly I asked him. Can you pray here, Betwana?
The Aton Queen shook her head.
Only in Aton itself. I'm going to talk to your god about that. It's really very inconvenient. She bent again and put her hand on Ngesa's chest. The Aton General appeared to stop breathing, and his face and body were suddenly covered with frost.
You've killed him, Betwana shrieked at her.
Oh, hush! I just froze him to stop the bleeding until I can get him to the island. The injury itself isn't so bad, but the bleeding's tearing up the rest of his brain. The freezing slows it down to a trickle. That's all I can do for right now, but it should be enough to keep his body from doing any more damage to itself while you're taking him back to Sarna.
There's no hope, Betwana said with a look of anguish.
What are you talking about? I can have him back on his feet in a day or two, but I have to take him to the island where I can control time. The brain is easy. It's the heart that's so... Well, never mind that. Listen closely, Betwana. As soon as you and Vanyan get him to Sarna, I want you to go across the Aton border as fast as you can run. As soon as you get across that line, fall on your knees and start praying to your god. He'll be stubborn, he always is, but keep after him. Make a pest of yourself until he gives in. I need his permission to take Engessa to my island. If nothing else works, promise him that I'll do something nice for him some day. Don't be too specific, though. Keep bearing down on the fact that I can save Engessa, and he can't.
I will do as you have commanded, Divine One, Betwana declared.
I didn't command, Betwana. I only suggested. I don't have the authority to command you. The child goddess turned to Vanyan. Let me see your sword, she said. I want to have a look at this yellow blood.
Vanyan drew his sword and offered it to her hilt first. She shuddered.
You hold it, dear one. Steel makes me nauseous.
She squinted at the stains on the blade.
Astonishing, she murmured. That isn't blood at all.
It's what came out of them when we cut them.
Perhaps, but it's still not blood. It's some kind of bile. Clell's going a little far afield for allies. Those giants you ran across don't come from here, Vanyan. They aren't like any creatures on this world.
We noticed that almost immediately, Divine One.
I'm not talking about their size or shape, Vanyan. They don't even seem to have the same kind of internal organs as the humans and animals. I guess that they don't even have lungs.
Everything has lungs, Afriel, except maybe fish.
That's here, dear one, if these creatures have bile in their veins instead of blood, then they're relying on their livers for...
She broke off, frowning.
I guess it is possible,
she said a little dubiously.
I'd hate to smell the air on their world, though.
You do know that I haven't got the foggiest idea of what you're talking about, don't you?
She smiled. That's all right, dear one. I love you anyway.
Thank you.
Don't mention it.
It could be good country, friend Takumi, Kring said, adjusting his black leather jerkin and looking around at the rocky desert. It's open and not too rugged. All it needs is water and a few good people.
The two of them rode at the front of their disorganized mob of Poloi. Takumi grinned.
When you get right down to it, friend Kring, that's all hell really needs.
Kring laughed.
How far is it to this Seneskan camp? He asked. Another 5 leagues. It's easy fighting, Domi Kring. The Seneskans ride horses and carry curved swords much like your sabers, but their horses are scrubby and not very good, and the Seneskans are too lazy to practice their swordsmanship. To make it even better, they wear flowing robes with big floppy sleeves. Half the time they get tangled up in their own clothing.
Kring's grin was wolfish.
They run fairly well, though, Takumi added. But they always come back. To the same camps?
Kring asked incredulously. Takumi nodded.
It makes it even easier. We don't even have to go looking for them. Incredible! Are they using rotten tree stumps for leaders? From what I've heard, they're getting their orders from Sirgon.
Takumi rubbed his shaved scalp.
Do you think it might be heresy to suggest that even a god can be stupid? As long as you don't say it about our god, I think you're safe. I wouldn't want to get in trouble with the church. Patriarch Emban's a reasonable man, Domi Takumi. He won't denounce you if you say unflattering things about our enemy.
Kring raised up in his stirrups to peer across the brown, gravel-strewn expanse of the desert of Seneska.
I'm looking forward to this, he said. I haven't been in a real fight for a long time.
He sank back into his saddle.
Oh, I almost forgot. I talked with friend Oscania about the possibility of a bounty on Seneskan ears. He said no. That's a shame. Men fight better if they've got an incentive of some kind. It even gets to be a habit. We had a fight with the trolls up in northern Aton, and I had a dead troll's ear half sawed off before I remembered nobody was around to buy it from me. That's a funny-looking hill up there, isn't it?
He pointed ahead at an almost perfectly shaped dome rearing up out of the desert floor.
It is a little odd, Takumi agreed. There aren't any rocks on its sides, just dust. Probably some kind of dust dune. They have sand dunes down in Rendor that look like that. The wind whirls the sand around and leaves it in round hills. Would dust behave like sand? Evidently so. There's the proof just up ahead.
And then, even as they watched, the hill split down the middle and its sides fanned out. They stared at the triangular face of Klel as he rose ponderously to his feet, shedding great waterfalls of dust from his gleaming black wings. Kring reined in sharply.
I knew something wasn't right about that hill, he exclaimed,
cursing his own inattention as their men surged around them.
He didn't come alone this time, Takumi shouted. He had soldiers hidden under his wings. Hold!
Big devils, aren't they?
Kring squinted at the armored warriors rushing toward them.
Big or little, though, they're still infantry. And that's all the advantage we need, isn't it? Right, Takumi chortled. This should be more fun than chasing Seneskans. I wonder if they've got ears, Kring said, drawing his saber. If they do, we might just want to gather them up. I still haven't given up on friend Oscania yet. There's one way to find out, Takumi said, hefting his javelin and leading the charge.
The standard Poloi tactics seemed to baffle Klel's soldiers. The superb horses of the nomads were as swift as deer, and the eastern Poloi's preference for the javelin over the saber was an additional advantage. The horsemen split up into small groups and began their attack. They slashed forward in long files, each group concentrating on one of the steel-masked monsters, and each Poloi hurling his javelin into the huge bodies at close range and then swerving away to safety. After a few such attacks, the front ranks of the enemy warriors bristled like hedgehogs with the short spears protruding from their bodies. The armored soldiers grew increasingly desperate, and they flailed ineffectually at their swift-charging tormentors with their brutal maces, savaging the unoffending air and almost never striking a solid blow.
"Good fight!" Kring panted to his friend after several charges. "They're big, but they're not quite fast enough."
"And not in very good condition, either," Takumi added. "That last one I skewered was puffing and wheezing like a leaky bellows."
"They do seem to be having some trouble getting their breath, don't they?"
Kring agreed. His eyes suddenly narrowed.
"Wait a minute. Let's try something. Tell your children to just ride in and then wheel and ride out again. Don't waste any more javelins."
"I don't quite follow, Domi.
Have you ever gone up into the high mountains?"
"A few times. Why?"
"Do you remember how hard it was to get your breath?"
"Right at first, I suppose. I remember getting a little lightheaded."
"Exactly. I don't know where Klel went to recruit these soldiers, but it wasn't from around here. I think they're used to thicker air. Let's make them chase us. Why go to all the trouble of killing somebody if the air is going to do the job for you?"
"It's worth a try."
Takumi shrugged.
"It takes a lot of the fun out of it, though."
"We can have fun with the Seneskans later,"
Kring told him.
"Let's run Klel's infantry to death first, then we can go slaughter Sirgon's cavalry."
"Sort of follow my lead on this,"
Stragan told Talon as the two mounted the rickety stairs leading up to the loft.
"I've gotten to know Valish fairly well, so I can gauge his reactions a little better than you can."
"All right," Talon shrugged. "He's your fish. I'll let you play him." Stragan opened the door to the stale-smelling loft, and the two of them threaded their way through the clutter to Valish's corner. The bony Dacite in the brocade jacket was not alone. A gaunt Styric, with open, seeping sores on his face, slumped in a chair at the table. The Styric's right arm hung limply at his side, the right side of his ulcerated face sagged, and his right eyelid drooped down to almost totally cover the eye. He was mumbling to himself, evidently completely unaware of his surroundings.
"This isn't a good time, Vimer," Valish said.
"It's quite important, Master Valish,"
Stragan said quickly.
"All right. But don't take too long."
As they approached the table, Talon's stomach suddenly churned. An overpowering odor of putrefying flesh emanated from the comatose Styric.
"This is my master," Valish said shortly.
"Ogarajan?" Stragan asked.
"How did you know his name?"
"You mentioned it to me once, I think. Or maybe it was one of your friends. Isn't he a little sick to be out and about?"
"That's none of your concern, Vimer. What's this important information you have for me?"
"Not me, Master Valish. Reldan here picked up something."
"Speak up then, boy."
"Yes, Master Valish," Talon said, ducking his head in a sort of half-bow. "I went into a waterfront tavern earlier today, and I heard a couple of Edomish sailors talking. They seemed excited about something, so I slipped a little closer to find out why they were so worked up. Well, you know how Edomishmen feel about the Church of Kyrellos."
"Get on with it, Reldan."
"Yes, sir. I was only trying to explain. Anyway, one of the sailors had just reached port, and he was telling the other one to get word to somebody in Edom. Rebal, I think his name is. It seems that the first sailor had just come in from Valesia, and when he'd been leaving port there, his ship passed a fleet coming into the harbor at Valis. What's so significant about that? Valish demanded. I was just coming to that. What made the first sailor so excited was the fact that the ships he saw were all flying banners of the Church of Kyrellos, and the rails were lined with men wearing armor. He kept babbling something about church knights coming to impose heresies on the people of Tamale. Valish was staring at him in open-mouthed horror. As soon as I heard that part, I slipped away. Vimer here thought you might want to know about it, but I wasn't so sure. What difference should it make to us that the Alenes are arguing about religion? It doesn't involve us, does it?
How many ships?
Valish demanded in a half-strangled tone. His eyes were bulging. The sailor wasn't too specific, Master Valish. Talon smiled. I sort of got the impression that he ran out of the numbers that he knew the names of. I guess that fleet stretched from horizon to horizon. If those men in armor are church knights, I'd say that all of them are on board these ships. I've heard things about those people. I certainly wouldn't want to be the one they're coming after. How much would you say this information's worth, Master Valish? Valish reached for his purse without any protest.
Have any messengers from those camps out in the woods come by lately, Master Valish?
Stragan asked suddenly.
That's none of your concern, Vimer.
Whatever you say, Master Valish. All I was getting at is that you ought to warn them about talking in public. I came across a couple of men who looked as if they'd been living in the woods. One of them was telling the other that they couldn't do anything until Scarpa got instructions from Sirga. Who's Sirga? I've never heard of him.
It's not a who, Vimer, Talon said. It's a where. Sirga's a town over in Sineska.
Really?
Stragan's expression grew curious.
This is the first time I've ever heard the name. Where is it? What route would you take to get to Sirga?
The pathway lies close by the Well of the Guy, the diseased Ugarajan announced in a loud, declamatory voice.
Valish made a slightly strangled noise and ineffectually tried to wave his hands warningly in front of his master's face, but Ugarajan brushed him aside.
Keep mourning at thy back, the Styric continued.
Master Ugarajan,
Valish protested in a squeaky tone.
Silence, knave, Ugarajan thundered at him. I will answer this traveler's question. If it is his intent to present himself and bow down to Sirgon, he must know the way. Proceed, traveler, past the Well of the Guy, and trek northwesterly into the desert. Thy destination shall be the Forbidden Mountains, where none may go without Sirgon's leave except at their peril. When thou dost reach those black, forbidding heights, seek ye the Pillars of Sirgon, for without them to guide thee, Sirga will remain forever hidden.
Please, master.
Valish was helplessly wringing his hands as he stared in chagrin at the raving old lunatic.
I have commanded thy silence, knave. Speak once more, and thou shalt surely die.
He turned back to fix Stragan with his single wild eye.
Be not dismayed, traveler, by the plains of salt, which nomads fear to cross. Ride! Boldly ride across the dead whiteness, empty of life save only where miscreants labor in the quarries to mine the precious salt. From the verge of the plains of salt wilt thou behold low on the horizon before thee the dark shapes of the Forbidden Mountains, and if it please Sirgon, his fiery white pillars will guide thee to his hidden city. Let not the plain of bones disquiet thee. The bones are those of the nameless slaves who toil until death for Sirgon's chosen, and, having served their purpose, are then given to the desert. Beyond the plain of bones wilt thou come to the gates of illusion, behind which lies concealed the hidden city of Sirga. The eye of mortal man cannot perceive those gates. Stark they stand as a fractured wall at the verge of the Forbidden Mountains to bar thy way. Bend thine eye, however, upon Sirgon's two white pillars, and direct thy steps toward the emptiness which doth lie between them. Trust not the evidence which thine eye doth present unto thee, for the solid-seeming wall is as mist, and will not bar thy way. Pass through it, and proceed along the dark corridor to the Glen of Heroes, where lie the unnumbered regiments of Sirgon in restless sleep, awaiting the trumpet call of his mighty voice, summoning them forth once more to smite his enemies.
Valish stepped back a pace and urgently beckoned to Talon to follow him. Curious, Talon followed the Dacite.
"Don't pay any attention to Master Ogorajan, boy," Valish said urgently. "He hasn't been well lately, and he has these spells quite often."
"I'd already guessed that, Master Valish. Shouldn't you get him to a physician? He's really raving, you know."
"There's nothing a physician could do for him," Valish shrugged. "Just make sure that Vimer understands that the old man doesn't know what he's talking about."
Valish seemed unusually concerned about Ogorajan's ravings. "He already knows, Master Valish. Any time somebody starts throwing the these and thous around, you can be fairly sure that his saddle's starting to slip." The diseased Styric was still raving in that hollow, declamatory voice.
"Beyond the Glen of Heroes wilt thou see the Well of Sirgon, sparkling in the sun and sustaining the hidden city. Close by the well, in fields laced with channels, thou wilt see Black Sirga rising like a mountain within its walls of night. Go boldly there and into the city of the blessed Sirgai. Mount the steep streets to the summit of that enclosed peak, and there at the crown of the known world thou wilt find amid that blackness the white, where columns of chalk bear the lintels and roof of the Holy of Holies, wherein Sirgon burns eternal upon the sacred altar. Fall upon thy face in that awful presence, crying, Vanet, Tjek Alkor, Yala Sirgon! And should it please him, he will hear thee, and should it please him not, he will destroy thee. Thus, traveler, is the way to the hidden city, which lieth at the heart of mighty Sirgon, King and God of all that was, all that is, and all that shall ever be."
Then the crazed Styric's face contorted into a grotesque mask of glee, and he began to cackle in a shrill, meaningless giggle. Chapter 14.
"All right, Sparhawk, you can turn around now."
"Are you dressed?"
She sighed.
"Just a minute."
There was a satiny rustle.
"Will this do?"
she asked tartly. He turned. The goddess was wrapped in a shimmering white robe.
"That's a little better," he told her.
"Prude, give me your hand."
He took her slender hand in his, and they drifted upward, rising out of the forested hills just east of Dirges.
"Sarna's somewhat to the west of due south," he told her.
"I know where it is."
Her tone was crisp.
"I was just trying to be helpful."
The ground beneath them began to flow back as they sped southwesterly.
"Can people see us from the ground?"
he asked curiously.
"Of course not. Why?"
"Just wondering. It occurred to me that if they can, it might explain a lot of the wild stories that crop up in folklore."
"You humans are very creative. You can invent wild stories without any help from us."
"You're in a disagreeable frame of mind today. How long is it going to take us to get there?"
"Just a few minutes."
"It's an interesting way to travel."
"It's overrated."
They drifted on in silence for a while.
"That's Sarna just ahead,"
Afriel said.
"Do you think Vanyan's reached here by now?"
"I doubt it. Later today, probably. We're going down."
They settled gently to earth in a clearing a mile or so from the northern edge of the city, and Afriel returned to the more familiar form of flute.
"Carry me,"
she said, reaching up to him.
"You know how to walk."
"I just carried you all the way from Dirges. Fair is fair, Sparhawk."
He smiled.
"Only teasing, Afriel."
He lifted her into his arms and started through the forest toward town.
"Where to?"
he asked her.
"The Aton Barracks. Vanyan says that Itanya's there."
She frowned.
"Oh, that's really impossible,"
she burst out.
"What's wrong?"
"Cyrenogian's hopelessly inept. I can't make any sense out of what he's saying."
"Where is he?"
"At Samar. He's trying to tell me about something Kring and Takumi just discovered, but I'm only getting about every third word. Why won't the man concentrate on his studies?"
"Anosian sort of,
The word you're looking for is lazy, Sparhawk."
"He likes to conserve his energy,"
Sparhawk defended his fellow Pandian.
Of course he does. She frowned. Stop a minute, she said.
What's the matter?
I just thought of something.
What now?
It just occurred to me that Tinian may have been a little unselective when he was gathering those knights he brought back from Kyrellos.
He brought the best men he could lay his hands on.
I think that's the problem. I've been wondering why I haven't been getting any reports from Comier. I don't think Tinian left him a single Pandian who has any more skill than Enosian does. There aren't all that many of you who can reach out more than a few leagues, and Tinian seems to have inadvertently commandeered them all.
Could you make any sense at all about what Enosian was trying to tell you?
It's something about breathing. Somebody's having problems with it. I'll run on down there after we talk with Itania. Maybe Enosian can be coherent if I'm in the same room with him.
Be nice.
They passed through the city gates and entered Sarna. Sparhawk carried the child goddess through the narrow streets to the bleak stone fortress that housed the local Aton garrison. They found the red-mantled Itania in a large conference room, examining the map that covered one entire wall.
Ah, Itania, Sparhawk said. There you are.
He set flute down on her feet.
I'm afraid you have the advantage of me, sir.
It's me, Itania. Sparhawk.
I'll never get used to that, Itania said. I thought you were in Beressa.
I was, until yesterday.
How did you get here so fast?
Sparhawk laid his hand on Flute's little shoulder.
Need you ask?
Oh, what brings you to Sarna?
Vanyan ran into trouble out in the desert. He's coming back. He and Betwana are bringing Angessa in on a litter.
Do you mean there's somebody in this world big enough to hurt Angessa? Perhaps not in this world, Itania,
Afriel told him.
Quell's brought in an army from someplace else. They're very strange. Vanyan and Betwana should get here this afternoon. Then Betwana has to go to Aton. How far is that?
Itania looked at the map.
15 leagues. Good. It shouldn't take her long, then. She has to get her god's permission for me to take Angessa to the island. The side of his head's been bashed in, and I can't fix that here.
Good God!
Itania exclaimed.
How nice of you to notice.
He smiled faintly.
What else is going on? He asked.
Quite a bit, Sparhawk told him. Zalasta tried to kill Sophrenia.
You're not serious.
I'm afraid so. We had to use Bellium to save her life.
Sparhawk!
Itania's eyes widened.
It's all right, Itania,
Afriel assured him, going across the room to him and holding out her hands.
Didn't that endanger Queen Elana?
He asked, lifting her into his lap.
Sparhawk shook his head. Zanisha can muffle those telltale noises, I guess. Elana's still safe, or so Bellium tells me.
His face, however, was worried.
Thank God!
You're welcome, Afriel said, but it was really Bellium's idea.
We still have some problems, though. Vanyan's encounter with Quell's army cost him about half of his knights.
That's disastrous! We won't be able to hold Samar without those knights!
Don't be quite so sure, Itania, she said. I just received a garbled message from a Pandian named Enosian. He's in Samar, and Kring and Takumi have discovered something about Quell's soldiers. I'll run down there and find out what's going on.
Quell's keeping an eye on Barad and Khalad, Sparhawk continued. They saw him while they were crossing the Sea of Arjun.
He rubbed at the side of his face.
Can you think of anything else, Afriel?
Lots of things, she replied, but they don't have much to do with what we're doing here.
She kissed Itania and slipped down out of his lap.
I shouldn't be too long, she told them. If Vanyan gets here before I come back, break the news about Sophrenia to him gently, and tell him that she's all right now. Keep a grip on him, gentlemen. It's winter time, and you need the roof on this building.
She went to the door, opened it, and vanished as she stepped through. Tiana lay on the north shore of the large lake known as the Sea of Arjun. It was a bustling Tamil town with an extensive harbor. As soon as the scruffy lake freighter docked, Barrett and Khalad led their horses ashore and mounted.
What was the name of that inn again?
Khalad asked.
The White Gull,
Barrett replied.
Poetic, Khalad noted.
The other names had probably already been used up.
You can only have so many lions and dragons and boars in one town before people start to get confused.
Krager's starting to give us more specific instructions in those notes, Khalad said. When he sent us to Sopal, he just gave us the name of the town. Now he's picking our accommodations for us. That might mean that we're getting closer to the end of this little excursion.
Sir Ulaf said that they're going to send us to Arjuna from here.
If I'd known we were going to spend so much time wandering around this lake, I'd have brought a fishing line.
I'm not really all that fond of fish myself.
Who is? It's an excuse to get outside. My brothers and I have found that if we lay around the house too long, our mothers start finding things for us to do.
You've got a strange family, Khalad. Most men only have one mother.
It was Father's idea. There's the White Gull.
Khalad pointed up the street. The inn was surprisingly clean and substantial. It had a well-maintained stable, and the rooms were neat, almost to the point of fussiness. The two young men saw to their horses, dropped their saddlebags off in their room, and took advantage of the bathhouse adjoining the rear of the inn. Then, feeling much improved, they adjourned to the taproom to pass the time until supper. Khalad rose and closely examined the porcelain stove.
"It's an interesting idea," he told Barrett. I wonder if it'd catch on in Eosia.
I sort of like looking at the fire myself, Barrett replied.
You can stare at the candles if that's all you want. A fireplace isn't very efficient, and it makes an awful mess. A stove's a lot more practical, and you can cook on it. When we get home, I think I'll build one for my mother's.
Barrett laughed. If you start tearing up their kitchen, they'll take their brooms to you.
I don't think so. The notion of a stew that doesn't have cinders floating in it might appeal to them.
The man who approached their table wore a hooded smock, and the hood partially concealed his face.
You don't mind if I join you, do you? He asked, sitting down and pushing the hood back slightly.
It was the same styrick they had last seen on the shore of the Gulf of Mysi.
You made good time, neighbor, Barrett said. Of course, you knew where you were going, and we didn't.
How long did it take you to get dry?
Khalad asked him.
Shall we skip the pleasantries? The styrick said coldly. I have further instructions for you.
You mean you didn't stop by just to renew our acquaintance?
Khalad said.
I'm crushed.
Very funny.
The styrick hesitated.
I'm going to reach into my pocket for the note, so don't start drawing your knives.
Wouldn't dream of it, old boy, Khalad drawled.
This is for you, Sparhawk.
The styrick handed Barrett the sealed parchment. Barrett took the parchment and broke the seal. He carefully lifted out the identifying lock of the queen's hair and read aloud, Sparhawk, go overland to Arjun. You'll receive further instructions there. Krager.
He must have been drunker than usual,
Khalad observed.
He didn't bother with all the snide little comments this time. Just out of curiosity, friend, why didn't he send us straight on to Arjun from Sopal? He could have saved everybody a great deal of time.
That's really none of your business, Aline. Just do as you're told.
I'm a peasant, Styrick, so I'm used to doing that. Prince Sparhawk here might get a little impatient, though, and that makes him bad-tempered.
Khalad squinted at the lumpy-faced messenger.
Since the subject's come up anyway, I've got a word of friendly advice for you, old boy. It's about 20 days on horseback from here to Arjun. He's going to be very unpleasant by the time he gets there. If you should happen to be the one who delivers the next message, I wouldn't get too close to him.
I think we can come up with a way for him to work off his bad temper, the styrick sneered.
You don't have 20 days to get to Arjun. You have 14.
He stood up.
Don't be late.
He turned and started toward the door.
Let's go,
Khalad said. Where?
After him.
What for? Khalad sighed.
To shake him down, Barrett,
he explained with exaggerated patience.
I want to strip him and go through his clothes. He just might have the next message on him.
Are you mad? They'll kill the queen if we do that.
Just because we rough up their messenger boy? Don't be silly. They want the bellium, and the queen's the only thing they've got to trade for it. we could routinely kill every single one of their messengers, and they wouldn't do a thing to her. Let's go shake that Styrek up a little bit, and go through his pockets. If we can get hold of the next message, we might be able to get the jump on them.
You know, I think you're right. They won't do anything to the Queen, will they?
Not a chance, my lord. Let's go teach that Styrek some manners. It's exactly the sort of thing Sparhawk would do.
He would, wouldn't he? Barrett looked closely at his friend. That fellow really irritates you, doesn't he?
Yes, as a matter of fact, he does. I don't like his attitude.
Well, let's go change it, then.
I'm not going to do anything foolish, Carlton said. I just want to have a look around.
The three of them were sitting under their tree in Narstal's cluttered jungle camp. They had a fire going, and three stolen chickens were spitted over it, dripping grease into the flames.
It won't hurt, Calidor said to Bevier. If the time ever comes when we have to go in there, we should probably know the lay of the land.
Are you sure you can keep a handle on your temper? Bevier asked Carlton. You'll be all alone there, you know.
I'm all grown up now, Bevier, Carlton assured him. I'm not going to do anything noisy until after things are back the way they should be. We may not get a chance like this again. Senga's invited me to go along to help him sell beer. It's the most natural thing in the world, and nobody's going to recognize me. I can pick up some very valuable information in the Taos, and if I happen to see somebody I recognize standing in a window or something, we'll know for sure exactly where those two friends of ours are located. Then the fellow with the broken nose can have a word with his blue friend, and they can lift them out before anybody can even blink. Then we can all go down there and explain to certain people just how unhappy we are.
I'm in favor of it myself, Calidor said to Bevier.
It's tactically sound, Bevier admitted. But, Carl here doesn't have any way to call for help if he gets in trouble.
I won't need any help, because I'm not going to do anything out of the ordinary. I'm going anyway, Shalag, so don't waste your breath trying to talk me out of it.
Senga came across the littered camp.
The cart's all loaded, Carl, he called. Are you about ready?
Carlton stood up.
Any time you are, Senga, he replied,
pulling his half-cooked chicken off the spit and going to join his newfound friend.
I'm getting bored just sitting here counting trees.
It took the two of them about 3 hours to reach Nataos, since there was no real way to hurry an ox. The trail was fairly well traveled, and it wound around through the jungle, following the course of least resistance.
There it is,
Senga said as the cart jolted through a ford that crossed a narrow stream. He pointed across the stump-dotted clearing at an ancient city, a ruin so old that the passage of centuries had rounded down the very stones.
Stay close to me when we get there, Carl. There are a couple of places we have to keep away from. There's one building right near the gate that they really don't want anybody to go near.
Oh? Carlton said, squinting at the mossy ruin ahead. What's inside that makes them so touchy?
I haven't the faintest idea, and I'm not curious enough to risk my health by asking.
Maybe it's their treasure house, Carlton speculated. If this army's as big as you say, they've probably picked up quite a bit of loot.
Senga shrugged.
It could be, I suppose, but I'm not going to fight all those guards just to find out. We're here to sell beer, Carl. We'll get a goodly share of their treasure that way, and it's not as risky.
But it's so honest, Carlton objected, grinning. Isn't honest work immoral for people like us?
Senga laughed and tapped the ox's rump with the long, slender stick he carried. The creaking cart jolted over the uneven ground toward the moldering walls.
Ho, Senga!
One of the slovenly guards at the gate greeted Carlton's friend.
What kept you? It's been as dry as a plate of sand since the last time you left.
You fellows are overworking my brewer, Senga replied. He can't keep up with the demand. We have to let the beer age a little while before you drink it. Green beer does funny things to a man's guts.
You haven't raised your prices again, have you?
No, same price as before.
10 times what you paid for the beer in the first place, I'll wager.
Oh, not quite that much. Where do you want me to set up?
Same place as last time. I'll pass the word and they'll start lining up.
I want some guards this time, Mandra, Senga told him. I don't want another riot when the last cask runs dry, the way there was last week.
I'll see to it. Save some for me.
The ox cart clattered through the gate and into a wide street where most of the moss had been worn off the cobblestones. A great deal of work had clearly taken place here in the Taos in the past few years. The squared-off stones of the broken walls had been rather carelessly restacked and then shored up with peeled log braces. Long-vanished roofs had been replaced with crude thatching made of tree limbs, providing nesting sites for raucous tropical birds, and here and there blackened piles of half-burned trees and bushes marked the places where indifferent workmen had attempted to dispose of the mountains of brush that had been cleared from the streets and houses. The men living here lounged idly in the streets. There were Alenes from Astel, Edom, and Daconia, as well as Arjunais and Seneskins. They were a roughly dressed, unshaven lot, who showed no signs that they even knew the meaning of the word discipline.
"What price are you getting for this?"
Carlton asked, patting one of the beer barrels in the cart.
"A penny a gill," Senga replied. "That's outrageous."
"They don't have to buy it,"
Senga shrugged.
"Get the money before you start to pour. Don't take promises."
"You've put my moral qualms to rest, Senga,"
Carlton laughed.
"At that price, this is hardly honest."
"There's that building I was telling you about."
Carlton tried to look casual as he turned to stare at the substantial-looking ruin.
"They really don't want anybody to look into that place," he said. "Those bars on the windows make it look like a jail."
"Not quite, Carl. Those bars are there to keep people out, not in."
Carlton grunted, still staring intently at the building. The barred windows had panes of glass in them, cheap, cloudy glass that had been poorly installed. Drapes on the inside cut off any possibility of seeing anything or anyone who might be in there. There were guards at the door, and other guards stationed at every corner. Carlton wanted to howl with frustration. The gentle girl who had become the center of his life was possibly no more than 20 yards away, but she might as well have been on the other side of the moon. And even if she were to look out through that clouded glass, she would not recognize his altered features. Senga paid the guards in the square with beer, and then he and his friend got down to work. Scarpa's rebels were rowdy, shouting and laughing, but they were generally in a good humor. They lined up in an orderly fashion and came to the rear of the cart 2 by 2, where Senga and Carlton filled their containers with the amber beer. There were a few arguments about the capacity of the assorted tankards, jugs, and pails, but Senga's word on the subject was final, and anyone who objected too loudly was sent back to the end of the line to think things over for an hour or so while he worked his way back to the front again. It was after the two entrepreneurs had drained the last barrel and sent the disappointed latecomers away that Carlton saw a familiar figure come weaving across the mossy square toward the ox cart. Krager was not wearing well. His head was shaved, and as pale as a fish belly, and his dissipated face was eroded by decades of hard drinking. His clothing, though obviously expensive, was wrinkled and filthy. He shook continually with a palsied tremor that ran through him in waves.
"I don't suppose you brought any wine?" he asked Senga hopefully.
"Not much call for it," Senga told him, refastening the tailgate of the cart. "Most of these fellows want beer."
"Do you know any place where you can get wine?"
"I can ask around. What's your preference?"
"Archean Red, if you can find any."
Senga whistled.
"That will cost you, my friend. I could probably chase down some of the local reds for you, but the imported stuff, that's going to take a big bite out of your purse."
Krager smirked at him.
"It's no problem," he said in his slurred voice. "I'm what you might call independently wealthy at the moment. These local reds taste like pig swill. I want real wine."
"It might take a while," Senga told him dubiously. "I've got contacts in Delo that might be able to find some for you, but Delo's a long way off."
"When are you coming back?"
"A couple of days. The brewery where I buy this slop's running day and night, but I still can't keep up."
"Bring me a couple of barrels of the local pig swill, then. Enough to tide me over until you can find me some Archean Red."
You can count on me, Senga assured him.
He gave Krager a hard look.
I'll need something in advance, though. I'll have to buy the Archean Red before I can sell it to you. I'm doing fairly well, but I'm not that rich yet.
Krager fumbled for his purse. Calton was suddenly gripped by an almost intolerable impatience. He was sure now that Aileen was here. Krager's presence virtually confirmed it. The prisoners were almost certainly being held in the building with barred windows. He absolutely had to get back to Narstal's camp so that Bevier could pass the word on to Afriel. If Zamisha could enter Natayos unseen, she could either penetrate the prison walls or reach into Krager's wine-sodden mind to verify what was almost a certainty now. If all went well, it would be no more than a few days until he and Sparhawk were reunited with the women they loved. Then they could all come here and do unpleasant things to the people responsible. Vanyan and Betwana reached Sarna late that afternoon, and the Yaitan Queen scarcely paused before setting out for the border.
It was ghastly, Sparhawk, Vanyan said,
leaning wearily back in his chair and putting his visored helmet on the table.
They're like no soldiers I've ever seen before. They're big, and they're fast, and their hides are so tough that most of the time my sword just bounced off them. I don't know where Clell found them, but they've got yellow blood, and they made mincemeat out of my knights.
Kring and Takumi ran into them as well, I guess, Sparhawk told him. Anosian tried to pass word to Afriel, but he garbled the spell so badly that she couldn't make any sense out of it. She's a little unhappy with Tinian. When he was gathering up the knights he brought back to Mytherian, he accidentally picked every Pandian who has the least bit of skill with the spells. That's why she can't get any reports from Comier.
We might have to send somebody to join him and handle communications, except that it'd take weeks for him to get there.
Not if Afriel takes him, it won't, Sparhawk disagreed. She carried me from Baressa to Sopal, almost 1,000 miles, in about a half an hour.
You're not serious.
You'll love flying, Vanyan.
You're carrying tails, Sparhawk.
They turned quickly. The child goddess was sitting in a chair at the far end of the room with her grass-stained little feet up on the table.
I wish you wouldn't do that, Sparhawk told her.
Would you prefer some kind of announcement, Sparhawk? Multitudes of spirits bawling hymns of praise to introduce me? It's a little ostentatious, but I can arrange it.
Just forget I said anything.
I'll do that. I had a chat with Anosian, and he's practicing now. Very hard. Kring and Takumi ran across Clell and his soldiers out in the desert, and they discovered something you gentlemen should know. I was right, Vanyan. Clell's soldiers have bile in their veins instead of blood, because they breathe with their livers. That means that the air where they come from isn't anything like the air here. Probably something like marsh gas. There's something in it that they need, and they can't get it out of our air. The Pelora used their standard cut-and-run tactics, and after a little while, those monsters started to collapse. Next time you come up against them, just turn around and run away. If they try to chase you, they'll choke to death. Did Betwana leave?
Yes, Divine One, Itanya replied.
Good. The quicker I can get Engessa to my island, the quicker I'll have him back on his feet.
I've been meaning to ask you about that, Sparhawk said. You say that his brain's been injured.
Yes.
The brain's very complicated, isn't it?
Yours aren't quite as complex as ours, but they aren't simple by any means.
And you can heal Angessa's brain on your island?
Of course.
If you can fix a brain, you should be able to fix somebody's heart. Why didn't you just take Sophrenia to your island and heal her there? Why did you come to Baressa and try to steal Bellium?
What's this?
Vanyan exclaimed, coming to his feet.
Wonderful, Sparhawk, Afriel said dryly. I'm awed by your subtlety. She's all right, Vanyan. Bellium brought her back.
Vanyan smashed his fist down on the table and then controlled himself with an obvious effort.
Would it inconvenience anybody to tell me what happened?
He asked them in an icy voice.
We were in Dirges.
Afriel shrugged.
Sophrenia was alone in the room, and Zelasta came in and stabbed her in the heart.
Good God!
She's fine, Vanyan. Bellium took care of it. She She's coming along very well. Vanisha's with her.
Vanyan started toward the door.
Oh, come back here, the child goddess told him. As soon as I get Engesa to the island and deal with his injury, I'll take you to Dirges. She's asleep now anyway, and you've seen her sleep before. Lots of times.
Vanyan flushed slightly, and then looked a bit sheepish.
You still haven't answered my question, Sparhawk said. If you can fix a brain, why can't you fix a heart?
Because I can shut a brain down to work on it, Sparhawk, she replied in a long-suffering tone. The heart has to keep on beating, and I can't work on it while it's jumping around like that.
Oh, I guess that makes sense. Do you happen to know where I could find Zelasta?
Vanyan asked in a dreadful voice.
He's probably gone back to Natayos, Afriel replied.
After I visit Sophronia, do you suppose you could take me there? I'd really like to have a talk with him.
I get his heart, the child goddess said.
Vanyan gave her a strange look.
It's an ongoing joke, Sparhawk told him.
I'm not joking, Sparhawk, Afriel said bleakly.
We can't go to Natayos, Sparhawk said. Aelana might be there, and Scarpa will kill her if we come pounding on the gate. Besides, I think you'll have to talk with Quadge before you do anything to Zelasta. Quadge? Vanyan asked.
Tinian told Afriel that Quadge has his own plans for our Styric friend. He wants to set him on fire.
I've got some more interesting ideas, Vanyan said grimly.
I wouldn't be so sure, my lord. Quadge wants to set Zelasta on fire, but he doesn't want to burn him to death. He's talking about an eternal flame, with Zelasta screaming in the middle of it, forever.
Vanyan considered that.
What a merry idea, he said finally.
My lady, Aelin whispered urgently, come quickly. Zelasta's returned.
Aelana drew the linen headcloth down over her forehead and joined her maid at the defective window. The wimple had been Aelin's idea. It fit snugly over the queen's ravaged scalp and covered her throat and the underside of her chin as well. It was uncomfortable, but it concealed the horror Krager's knife had made of her hair. She bent and looked out through the small triangular opening in the window. Zelasta's gaunt face was twisted with grief, and his eyes were dead. Scarpa came hurrying up, his face eager.
"Well?" he demanded.
"Go away, Scarpa," Zelasta told him.
"I only wanted to be sure you were all right, father," Scarpa replied with obvious insincerity.
Scarpa had fashioned a crude crown for himself out of a serving bowl made of hammered gold. He was evidently unaware of how absurd he looked with the lopsided adornment perched on his shaved head.
"Leave me," Zelasta thundered. "Get out of my sight."
"Is she dead?"
Scarpa ignored the dreadful threat implicit in his father's voice. Zelasta's face hardened.
"Yes," he replied in a strangely neutral tone. "I drove my knife straight into her heart. I'm deciding right now whether or not I can live with what I've done. Please stay, Scarpa. By all means. This was your idea after all. It was such a marvelous notion that I may want to reward you for it."
Scarpa backed away, his suddenly rational eyes now filled with fear. Zelasta barked two words in Styric and reached out his hand. His fingers curved like hooks. Scarpa clutched at his belly and screeched. His makeshift crown fell unnoticed as Zelasta implacably dragged him back.
"You're pathetically obvious, Scarpa," Zelasta grated,
his face only inches from his son's.
"But your plan had one minor flaw. I may very well kill myself for what I did to Sophronia. But I'll kill you first, just as unpleasantly as I possibly can. I may just kill you anyway. I don't really like you, Scarpa. I felt a certain responsibility for you, but that's a word you wouldn't understand."
His eyes suddenly burned.
"Your madness must be contagious, my son. I'm starting to lose my grip on sanity myself.
You talked me into killing Sophronia, and I loved her far more than I could ever love you.
He unhooked his fingers.
Run away, Scarpa. Pick up your cheap toy crown and run. I'll be able to find you when I decide to kill you.
Scarpa fled, but Elana did not see him leave. Her eyes were filled with tears, and she turned from the window with a grief-stricken wail. Chapter 15. It was snowing in Sarna when Sparhawk woke the following morning, a thick, heavy snow that swirled and danced in the driving wind coming down out of the Aton Mountains lying to the north. Sparhawk looked sourly out of the window of his barracks room, then pulled on his clothes and went looking for the others. He found Itanya sitting by the stove in the war room with a sheaf of documents in his lap. "Something important?" he asked as he entered.
"Hardly," Itanya replied.
He made a face and put the papers away.
"I made a serious blunder last spring before Oscania uprooted me and sent me to Sinestra. I was teaching a class in foreign relations at the university, and I slipped and said the fatal words, 'Write a paper.' Now I've got a bale of these things to plow through."
He shuddered.
"Bad?"
"Unbelievably so. Undergraduates should never be allowed to touch a quill pen. So far I've encountered 15 different versions of my own lecture notes, all couched in graceless, semi-literate prose."
"Where's Vanyan?"
"He's checking on his wounded. Have you seen Afriel yet this morning?"
Sparhawk shook his head. "She could be anywhere."
"Did she actually fly you here from Dirgis?"
"Oh, yes, and up from Beressa before that. It's an unusual experience, and it always starts with the same argument."
Itanya gave him a questioning look.
"She has to revert to her real form when she does it."
"Blazing light, trailing clouds of glory and all that?"
"No, nothing like that. It's just that with us, she always poses as a little girl. But actually, she's a young woman."
"What do you argue with her about?"
"Whether or not she's going to wear clothes. The gods evidently don't need them, and they haven't quite grasped the concept of modesty yet. She's a bit distracting when she first appears."
"I can imagine." The door opened, and Vanyan came in, brushing the snow off the shoulders of his cloak.
"How are the men?" Sparhawk asked him.
"Not good," the preceptor replied. "I wish we'd known more about Clell's soldiers before we closed with them. I lost a lot of good knights needlessly during that skirmish. If I'd had my wits about me, I'd have suspected something when they didn't pursue us after we broke off our attack."
"How long were you engaged?"
"It seemed like hours, but it was probably no longer than 10 minutes.
"When you get to Samar, you might want to talk with Kring and Takumi. We should try to get some idea of just how long those soldiers can function in our air before they start to collapse."
Vanyan nodded. There was really nothing for them to do, and the morning dragged sluggishly by. It was shortly before noon when Betwana, clad in close-fitting otterskin clothing, came running effortlessly out of the swirling snow. Her almost inhuman stamina was somehow unnerving. She seemed hardly winded and not even flushed as she entered the room where they waited.
"Invigorating,"
she noted absently as she peeled off her outer garment. She took one lock of her night-dark hair and stretched it out to look critically at its sodden length.
"Does anyone have a comb?" she asked.
They all started at the sound of a blaring trumpet fanfare from the other end of the room. They spun around and saw the child goddess. She was surrounded by a nimbus of pure light. She sat sedately in mid-air, and she was smiling sweetly at Sparhawk.
"Is that sort of what you had in mind?"
she asked him. He cast his eyes upward.
"Why me?" he groaned.
Then he looked at her smiling little face.
"I give up, Afriel," he said. "You win."
"Of course. I always win."
She gently settled to the floor, and her light dimmed.
"Come here, Betwana. Let me comb that out for you."
She held out her hands, and a comb appeared in one and a towel in the other. The Queen of the Aetons went to her and sat in the chair.
"What did he say?"
Afriel asked, as she began to wrap Betwana's dripping hair in the length of cloth.
"He said no right at first," the
the queen replied, and no, the second and third times as well. He started to weaken about the 12th time, as I remember it. I knew it would work. Afriel smiled, working the towel through Betwana's locks.
Are we missing something? Vanyan asked her.
The Aetons don't call on their god very often, so he almost has to respond when they do. He was probably concentrating on something else, and each time Betwana called him, he had to put it down and go see what she wanted.
I was very polite, Betwana smiled, but I did keep asking. He's afraid of you, Divine One.
I know. Afriel laid down her towel and picked up the comb. He thinks I'm going to steal his soul or something. He won't come anywhere near me.
I let him know that I was going to keep on calling him until he gave me permission, Betwana went on, and he finally gave in.
They always do, Afriel shrugged. You'll get what you want eventually if you just keep asking.
It's called nagging, Divine One, Sparhawk told her.
How would you like to listen to a few days of trumpet fanfare, Sparhawk? She asked.
No thanks. It was good of you to ask, though.
He definitely gave his permission? Afriel asked the queen. Betwana smiled.
Very definitely. He said, tell her she can do anything she wants. Just leave me alone.
Good. I'll take Engessa to the island, then. Afriel pursed her lips. Maybe you'd better send a runner to your husband. Tell him about Quell's soldiers. I know your husband, so you'll have to order him not to attack them. I've never known anyone so totally incapable of turning around as he is.
I'll try to explain it to him, Betwana said a little dubiously.
Good luck. Here. Afriel handed over the comb. I'll take Engessa to the island, thaw him out, and get started.
Ulath called a halt on the outskirts of town, and Glockef summoned Gnome. The god of Eid appeared, holding the half-eaten hindquarter of some large animal in one huge paw.
We have reached the place where the one called Barret has been told to come,
Ulath told the huge troll god.
It would be well now if we come out of no time and go into the time of broken moments.
Gnome gave him a baffled look, clearly not understanding what they were doing.
Ulath and Tinin hunt thought, Glockef explained. The man-things have bellies in their minds as well as the bellies in their bellies. They have to fill both bellies. Their belly bellies are full now. That is why they ask this. It is their wish to now fill their mind bellies.
A slow look of comprehension began to dawn on Gnome's brutish face.
Why did you not say this before, Ulath from Thalesia?
Ulath groped for an answer.
It was Glockef who found that we have mind bellies, Tinian stepped in. We did not know this. We only knew that our minds were hungry. It is good that Gworg sent Glockef to hunt with us. Glockef is a very good hunter.
Glockef beamed. Ulath quickly expanded the metaphor.
Our mind bellies hunger for thoughts about the wicked ones, he explained. We can track those thoughts in the bird noises the man-things make when they speak. We will stand on one side of the broken moment where they cannot see us, and listen to the bird noises they are making. We will follow those tracks to the ones we hunt, and they will not know we are there. Then we will listen to the bird noises they make, and learn where they have hidden Annika's mate.
You hunt well, Gnome approved. I had not thought of this kind of hunting before. It is almost as good as hunting things to eat. I will help you in your hunt.
It makes us glad that you will, Tinian thanked him. Arjun was the capital of the kingdom of Arjuna, a substantial city on the south shore of the lake. The royal palace and the stately homes of the noble families of the kingdom lay in the hills on the southern edge of town, and the commercial center was near the lakefront. Ulath and Tinian concealed their horses and proceeded on foot through the gray half-light of Gnome's broken moments into the city itself. Then they split up and began to search for the food their mind-bellies craved. Glockef went looking for dogs. It was almost evening when Ulath came out of another of the seedy taverns near the docks on the east side of town.
This is going to take all month, he muttered to himself.
The name Scarpa had cropped up in a few of the conversations he had overheard, and each time he had heard it, he had eagerly drawn closer to listen. Unfortunately, however, Scarpa and his army were general topics of conversation here, and Olaf had not been able to pick up anything that was at all useful.
"Get out of my way!"
The voice was harsh, peremptory. Olaf turned to see who was being so offensive. The man was a richly dressed Dacite. He was riding a spirited black horse, and his face bore the marks of habitual dissipation. Though he had never seen the fellow before, Olaf recognized him immediately. Talon's pencil had captured that face almost perfectly. Olaf smiled.
"Well now," he murmured, "that's a little better."
He stepped out into the street and followed the prancing black horse. Their destination was one of the grand houses near the royal palace. A liveried servant rushed from the house to greet the sneering Aline. "We've been eagerly awaiting your arrival, my lord," he declared, bowing obsequiously.
"Get somebody to take care of my horse," the Aline snapped as he dismounted. "Is everybody here?"
"Yes, Baron Perak."
"Astonishing! Don't just stand there, fool. Take me to them at once."
"Yes, my lord Baron." Olaf smiled again and followed them into the house. The room to which the servant led them appeared to be a study of some kind. The walls were lined with bookcases, though the books shelved there showed no signs of ever having been opened. There were about a dozen men in the room, some Aline, some Arjunai, and even one Styrek.
"Let's get down to business,"
Baron Perak told them, negligently tossing his plumed hat and his gloves down on the table. "What have you to report?"
"Prince Sparhawk has reached Tiana, Baron Perak," the lone Styrek told him.
"We expected that."
"We did not, however, expect his treatment of my kinsman. He and that brute he calls his squire followed our messenger and assaulted him. They tore off all his clothes and turned all his pockets inside out."
Perak laughed harshly.
"I've met your cousin Zorek," he said. "I'm sure he richly deserved it. What did he say to the prince to merit such treatment?"
"He gave them the note, my lord, and that ruffian of a squire made some insulting remark about a 20-day journey on horseback. My cousin took offense at that, and told them that they only had 14 days to make the journey."
"That was not in the instructions," Perak snapped. "Did Sparhawk kill him?"
"No, my lord."
Zorek's tone was sullen. "Pity," Perak said darkly. "Now I'll have to attend to it myself. You Styreks get above yourselves at times. When I have leisure, I'm going to run your cousin down and hang his guts on a fence, as an example to the rest of you. You're being paid to do as you're told, not to get creative." He looked around. "Who's got the next note?" he asked.
"I have, my lord," a rather prosperous-looking Edomishman replied.
"You'd better hold off on delivering it. Zorek's cousin upset our timetable with his excursion into constructive creativity. Let Sparhawk cool his heels here for a week or so, then give him the note that tells him to go on to Durell. Lord Scarper wants his army to start moving north before we send Sparhawk on to Natayos for the exchange."
"Baron Perak," a baggy-eyed Arjunai in a brocade doublet said arrogantly, "this delay, particularly here in the capital, poses some threat to my king. This Sparhawk person is notoriously irrational, and he does still have the Jewel of Power in his possession. His Majesty does not want that Aline barbarian lingering here in Arjun with spare time on his hands. Send him on to Durell immediately. If he's going to destroy some place, let it be Durell instead of Arjun."
"You have amazingly sharp ears, Duke Melanus," Perak said sardonically. "Can you really hear what King Rakia is saying when you're a mile from the palace?"
"I'm here to protect His Majesty's interests, Baron. I have full authority to speak for him. His Majesty's alliance with Lord Scarpa is not etched on a diamond. Keep Prince Sparhawk moving. We don't want him here in Arjun."
"And if I don't?"
Melanus shrugged.
"His Majesty will abrogate the alliance, and make a full report of what you people have been doing, and what you are planning to do, to the Tamil ambassador."
"I see that the old
saw about the stupidity of trusting in our Junai is still true.
Just do as you're told, Perak, Melanus snapped. Don't bore me with all these tedious protests and racial slurs. His Majesty's report to the ambassador has already been written. All he requires is an excuse to send it across town.
A servant entered with a flagon and a tray of wine glasses, and Olaf took advantage of the open door to slip from the room. It was going to take a while to round up Tinian and Blockus, and then they were going to have to compose a fairly extensive message to Afriel. After he had slipped out of the house, however, Sir Olaf very briefly indulged himself. He leapt high into the air with a triumphant bellow, smacking his hands together with glee. Then he composed himself and went looking for his friends. The black-armored Sir Heldon returned to rejoin Patriarch Bergston at the head of the column. "Any luck?" Bergston asked him. Heldon shook his head.
"Sir Tinian was very thorough," he rumbled in his deep basso. "He winnowed through the ranks of the Pandian Order like a man panning for gold. I think he took just about everybody who can even pronounce the Styric language."
"You know the spells?"
"Yes, but Afriel can't hear me. My voice is pitched too low for her ears."
"That raises some very interesting theological points," Brugston mused.
"Could we ponder them some other time, Your Grace? Right now, we have to get word of what happened in Zemok to Sparhawk and Venyon. The war could be over by the time Ambassador Fontan's messengers reach them."
"Talk with the other orders, Heldon," Brugston suggested.
"I don't think it would work, Your Grace. Each order works through the personal god of the Styric who taught them the secrets. We have to get word to Afriel. She's the one who's perched on Sparhawk's shoulder."
"Heldon, you spent too much time practicing with your weapons during your novitiate. Theology does have a purpose, you know."
"Yes, Your Grace,"
Heldon sighed, rolling his eyes upward and bracing himself for a sermon. "Don't do that," Brugston told him. "I'm not talking about a lean theology. I'm talking about the misguided beliefs of the Styrics. How many Styric gods are there?"
1,000, Your Grace," Heldon replied promptly. "Sophrenia always made some issue of that."
"Do these 1,000 younger gods exist independently of each other?"
"As I understand it, they're all related, sort of like a family."
"Amazing. You did listen when Sophrenia was talking to you. You Pandians all worship Afriel, right?"
"Worship would be too strong a term, Your Grace."
"I've heard stories about Afriel, Heldon." Bergston smiled. "She has a private agenda. She's trying to steal the whole of humankind. Now then, I'm a member of the Genidian Order." He paused. "I was," he corrected himself. "We make our appeals to Honka. The Cyrenics work through Romalic, and the Alcyones deal with Cetrus. Do you imagine that in their misty heaven somewhere above the clouds, these Styric gods might now and then talk with each other?"
"Please don't beat me over the head, Brixton. I overlooked something, that's all. I'm not stupid."
"Never said you were, old boy," Brixton smiled. "You just needed spiritual guidance, that's all. That's the purpose of our Holy Mother. Come to me with your spiritual problems, my son. I will gently guide you. And if guidance doesn't work, I'll take my axe and drive you."
"I see that Your Grace adheres to the notion of the church muscular," Heldon said sourly.
"That's my spiritual problem, my son, not yours. Now go find an Alcyone. Legend has it that Afriel and Cetrus are particularly close. I think we can count on Cetrus to pass things along to his thieving little cousin."
"Your Grace," Heldon protested.
"The church has had her eye on Afriel for centuries, Heldon. We know all about your precious little child goddess and her tricks. Don't let her kiss you, my friend. If you do, she'll pinch your soul while you're not looking."
There were a dozen wobbly ox carts this time, all heavily laden with beer barrels, and Senga had recruited several dozen of Narstal's shabby outlaws to assist him in guarding and dispensing his product. Colton had rather smoothly insinuated Kaalador and Bevier into the company.
"I still think you're making a mistake, Senga," Colton
told his good-natured employer, as their rickety cart jolted along the rough jungle path toward Matayo's.
You've got a complete lock on the market. Why lower your prices?
Because I'll make more money if I do.
That doesn't make sense.
Look, Carl, Senga explained patiently, when I came here before, I only had one cartload of beer. I could get any price I asked because my beer was so scarce.
I guess that makes sense.
I've got an almost unlimited supply now, though, so I'm making my profit on volume instead of price.
That's what doesn't make sense.
Let me put it this way. Which would you rather do? Steal 10 crowns from one man, or a penny from each of 10,000 men?
Carlton did some quick counting on his fingers.
Oh, he said. Now I see what you're driving at. Very shrewd, Senga.
Senga puffed himself up a little.
It never hurts to think long range, Carl. My real concern is the fact that it's not really all that hard to make beer. If some clever fellow's got a recipe, he could set up his own brewery right here. I don't want to get involved in a price war just when things are starting to go well for me.
They had left Narstal's camp at daybreak, and so it was mid-morning when they reached Natayos. They passed unchallenged through the gates, rumbled by the house with barred windows, and set up shop again in the same square as before. As Senga's closest associate, Carlton had been promoted to the position of chief of security. The reputation for unpleasantness he had established early on in Narstal's camp ensured that none of the outlaws would question his orders, and the presence of Bevier, patch-eyed, lacaber-armed, and obviously homicidal, added to his authority.
"We ain't likely to accomplish too much here, Carl,"
Collador muttered to Carlton, as the two of them stood guard near one of the busy beer carts. "Old Senga's so worried about some feller slipping by without paying that me and you is tied down tighter than a couple of dogs on short leashes."
"Wait until later, Ezek," Carlton advised. "We'll be able to move around a little more freely after everybody gets drunk."
Bevier slouched over to join them, his short-handled lacaber in his fist. People automatically got out of his way for some reason.
"I just had a thought," he said.
"You want to kill somebody?" Carlton suggested.
"Be serious, Carl. Why don't you take your friend Senga aside and suggest that he set up a permanent establishment here in the Tayos? It's the logical thing to do, and it'd give the three of us an excuse to stay here. If we cleaned out one of these ruined buildings and opened a tavern, we could stay here and run it. It makes more sense than selling beer off the tailgate of an ox cart."
"He's got hisself a point there, Carl," Collador said. "Old Shalag here, he looks like he drinks blood for breakfast, but his head's still a-workin' in back of that there eye patch."
Carlton thought about it.
"It would set us up right here in the Tayos, wouldn't it? We'd be able to keep an eye on things."
He looked around.
"Senga's a little worried that somebody here might start his own brewery," he said for the benefit of nearby soldiers. "If the three of us are right here, we could probably persuade anybody who does that to take up another hobby. I'll go talk with Senga and see what he thinks of the notion."
He found his good-natured friend sitting at a makeshift table behind one of the ox carts. The outlaw was counting money with an almost dreamy expression on his face.
"Oh, this is just fine, Carl," he almost crooned. "They're only pennies." "I know, but there are so many of them." "Shalag came up with an idea. He wants to thin out the crowd by hacking the head off every third man in line." "Shalag's not really that bad."
"Oh, really? Every man in camp has nightmares about him."
"He hasn't killed a single man since he came to Arjuna."
"He's saving up. He's just biding his time until he can gather up a few dozen of us all together and kill all of us at once."
"Do you want to listen to his idea, or haven't you finished making bad jokes yet?"
"Sorry. Go ahead."
"He thinks we ought to clean out one of these empty ruins and set up a permanent tavern."
"You mean like a real business? With a counter and tables and chairs and all that?"
"Why not? Now that your brewer's working full time, you've got access to a steady supply, and this is where your customers are. If you set up shop here, you can sell beer all day, every day, instead of just coming here once a week. Then your customers would come to you in manageable numbers,
instead of by the regiment.
I never thought of it, Senga admitted. I just thought I'd make a quick profit and then run for the border. I could set up a real tavern here, Carl. A real, honest-to-God, legitimate business. I wouldn't have to steal any more.
I've seen your price list, Senga. Don't worry. You're still stealing.
Senga ignored him. Maybe I could call it Senga's Palace, he said in a dreamy tone of voice. He frowned. No, he decided, that's a little too flashy for a beer tavern. I think I'll just call it Senga's. That'd definitely be a more lasting memorial than just a grave marker with the date when I got hung carved on it. Then he shook his head and sighed. No, Carl, he said regretfully, it wouldn't work. If I took you and my other guards out of here, Scarpa's soldiers would just march in and drink up all my beer without paying.
Why take us out, then? We can stay right here and make sure they pay.
I'm not sure Narstal would like it if we didn't go back to camp at night.
Senga, Carlton said gently, do you really need Narstal anymore? You're an honest businessman now. You shouldn't be associating with bandits.
Senga laughed. You're coming at me a little too fast, Carl. Give me some time to adjust my thinking.
Then he suddenly swore. What's wrong?
It's a beautiful idea, Carl, but it won't work.
Why not?
Because I'll need Scarpa's permission to set up shop here, and I'm not going to go anywhere near him to ask for it.
I don't think you'll have to, my friend. I went rummaging around through those heaps of trash in Narstal's camp yesterday, and guess what I found?
What?
A very fancy silver-mounted cask of Archean Red. It's even equipped with a silver spigot. The fellow who stole it didn't know how much it was worth. He's a beer man. I got it off him for half a crown. I'll sell it to you, and you can make a present of it to that Krager fellow. Why don't we let him persuade Scarpa to give you permission to go into business here?
Carl, you're a genius. What'll you take for that cask of Archean Red?
Oh, 5 crowns, I guess.
5 crowns? 10 times what you paid for it? That's robbery.
You ought to know, Senga. You're my friend, but business is business after all.
They found the bleary-eyed Krager sitting on a broken wall watching the crowd of thirsty soldiers in the square without much interest. He held a tankard in one hand, and he drank from it occasionally with obvious distaste.
Ah, there you are, Master Krager, Senga said jovially. Why don't you dump out that slop and try a sup of this?
He patted the ornate wine cask he was carrying under one arm.
More local swill? Krager asked.
Try it and see what you think, Senga suggested.
Krager emptied his wine out on the ground and held out his pewter tankard. Senga turned the handle of the silver spigot and dribbled about a half cupful of Archean Red into it. Krager squinted into his mug and sniffed at it suspiciously. Then his eyes rolled up ecstatically.
Oh, dearie, dearie me, he breathed in a reverent tone of voice.
He took a small sip and actually seemed to quiver with delight.
I thought you might like it, Senga said. Now that I've got your attention, I've got a business proposition for you. I'd like to set up a permanent tavern here in Natayos, but I'll need permission to do that. I'd take it as a real favor if you could see your way clear to put in a good word for me with Lord Scarpa. I'd be very grateful to you if you can get his approval.
How grateful? Krager asked quickly.
Probably about this grateful.
Senga patted the silver-mounted cask again. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.